and welcome to the 159th edition of Culture with me, Robert Pound. This week we're doing the Monster Mash, it's a graveyard smash. We're looking forward to Halloween. Are you sitting uncomfortably? Then I shall begin. We'll creep into the show with a look at the origins of Gothic with the curator of the British Library's new show on just that.
Gothic is above all appealing to our kind of emotions and plumbing our deepest kind of psychological depths to elicit fear in us when we read it.
We'll learn about an eerie fictional town in the US depicted through the podcast Welcome to Night Vale.
My favorite comparison is Twin Peaks, which has moments of absolute absurd comedy, and then a few minutes later, it is some of the scariest TV program you'll ever see.
And we'll go shopping to pick out the most frightening of Halloween costumes.
Ladies will come in here and they'll spend 2 hours sorting out their makeup, picking up the costumes, get on the phone to their other half and sit there and go, unless you get down here in the next 5 minutes, you're going as a ghost.
Plus, we'll be hiding behind the sofa for the Toronto After Dark Film Festival, and we'll be interspersing the scary stuff with live music from Seth Lakeman and a report from this year's CMJ Music Marathon in New York City. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Seth Lakeman is an English musician who's been around the folk block a few times. Since the 1990s, he's played with various ensembles, and over the past decade or so, he's established himself as a much applauded solo artist. He popped by Midori House recently to play us a few tracks from his most recent record, Word of Mouth, and here he is first with The Last Rider.
Sign is made, the words are said, a flag falls to the ground. A dog valves are quick and the steam is thick. The scrapper's yard he's bound, and the love we see, his fiery trails come rolling, climbing from the hills. And we proudly see his engine breathe as he stokes, smokes with his free will. On a rocky ridge and an iron bridge, he hurtles through the town. And you can see a spot 1 mile away as he rattles underground. And he makes no pause at the tunnel's jaw, stone silence, his only fear. In the dark alone his furnace goes, and the crackles of the sound he hears. The last rider, can you hear him cry? The last rider, can you hear him cry? The last rider, can you hear him cry? As he's rushing and he's racing down the line. Along the gorge he thunders on, at double speed he flies, affronting to the spitting sea like a bird his whistle cries. And it thrills his blood as he leaps along, and it scatters and he turns to face a storm. But those whirling wheels of straining steel throw sparks and they flicker in the door. The last rider, can you hear him cry? The last rider, can you hear him cry? The last rider, can you hear him cry? As he's rushing and he's racing down the line. Can you hear the bell of a sweet farewell come ringing through the land? And one final yawn with his froggy breath, he breaks from where he stands. This heavy deed of feeding steam, with its spits, stares into his eyes. And the lasting thought for this mighty force, then he steps, turns to wave goodbye. A goodbye, a goodbye, a goodbye. The last rider, can you hear him cry? The last rider, can you hear him cry? The last rider, can you hear him cry? As he's rushing and he's racing down the line.
That was Seth Lakeman performing The Last Rider. We're going to going to start at the very beginning of Spooky on the show today by uncovering the roots of horror, poking about in the very mausoleum of fright. We're going to get gothic. Fortunately for us, a new exhibition has just opened at the British Library dedicated to gothic. It's called Terror and Wonder, the Gothic Imagination, and its curator is Tim Pye, and he's floated through the studio glass to be with us, clad just in cobwebs.
The exhibition celebrating 250 years of Gothic literature. It starts in 1764 with Horace Walpole's The Castle of Otranto, which is considered the first Gothic novel. He had a nightmare in the summer of 1764, and he woke up and decided that it needed to be a novel, so he wrote for the next 8 weeks from dawn till dusk and produced this work that has every conceivable Gothic trope in it, and issued it and subtitled it A Gothic Story. And by doing that, he inadvertently coined the genre that's still going on today.
So it's from this book, The Castle of Otranto, which obviously, is even without the subtitle, it's The Castle of Otranto. It just sounds, in our minds, it's got presumably two of the elements of Gothic. It's got a European tradition, a sketchy European tradition, and a castle in it.
Yeah.
Was there any understanding of, in terms of literature, of what Gothic was before that? Had other playwrights, novelists sort of dabbled in things? Or did this become like the motherlode of Gothic? This is
where it all comes together into a recognisable Gothic novel. I mean, before that, you have people like Shakespeare and Hamlet, which is, you know, the ultimate Gothic story, populated with ghosts, murder, intrigue, a castle. But what Walpole's doing is he's taking pieces from Shakespeare and medieval literature and bringing it all together into a more kind of realistic 18th century prose. So he's turning it into a novel that people would easily read, but bringing in all those kind of imaginative elements from things that have gone before. There's nothing Gothic. The way he used it doesn't mean anything before he uses it, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
Gothic means medieval, or it means our barbaric history. But he's using it to say this is a medieval story.
And then that term becomes a signifier. People go, aha, I know what I'll find in this story. If something is described as Gothic, then it becomes this leitmotif. People are going to go, I'm going to get an element of the supernatural. I'm going to get an element of maybe sort of looking at the past and strange family histories and all these sorts of things. And these are the terms by which I guess people understand Gothic. Do we have any sort of misunderstandings with Gothic? Should it, for example, be scary? Does it always have to be scary? Does it always have to be supernatural?
I mean, that's one of the fundamental things about Gothic, is that it should be a tale that creates a sense of terror. So Gothic is above all appealing to our kind of emotions and plumbing our deepest kind of psychological depths to elicit fear in us when we read it. So that's one of the key things. But then, you know, what Gothic is to one person is different from what it is to another person. And there's a lot of aspects of Gothic that can appear in a novel or that don't appear. But there are some kind of recurring things. You've got foreboding atmospheres, you know, crumbling castles, pursuits, a sense of claustrophobia, murder, a tyrannical man who's chasing virginal maidens. And all that kind of stuff is interchangeable. But that's just what it is in the 18th century. You know, it changes throughout history. So in a Gothic novel now, you wouldn't expect to see all of those elements. It's changed a lot over the years.
What elements from Walpole's novel and the medieval and the barbaric and the sort of anti-pastoral and all these things that it isn't, it is and it isn't? I know that films like The Wicker Man are included in your show as well. Is there a very definite line to be drawn from those, or do you have to start scratching your head and sort of being creative with your curation?
Not at all. Hopefully people coming to the show will see that there is a very clear kind of history and a very linked history between all of these things. So, for example, if you look at the goth scene of the late 70s,
the early music 80s. Scenes. Yeah.
We have a section in the exhibition devoted to that. And you can just see from the paraphernalia, from the record covers, from the t-shirts that people were wearing, that the imagery is taken directly from all of this source material that's gone before. And you even find examples. I mean, Susie Sue was writing a lot of material based on Poe short stories, for example. And, you know, the first goth record is Bela Lugosi's Dead. So, you know, Dracula's there, film's there. So, yeah, you can see a link. There's a definite history.
I wonder if goth as a sort of music genre and as a youth tribe sort of has had its heyday, and maybe it's sort of splintered off into different things now.
Yeah, that's right. So I think you can definitely see there's a golden age of goth that ends in about 84, 85. So with people like Sisters of Mercy, who are kind of considered the last great goth band. And it kind of died a death after that. It's still there. I mean, you know, people go to Whitby, to twice a year to go and, like, you know, celebrate the goth subculture. And there are still plenty of bands that are performing in a goth way. And there's even, you know, a kind of new revival in goth music that's happening now.
And to go back to the future, to the end of your show, I think we end with some clips from Robin Hardy's The Wicker Man. It's sort of, on the face of it, a pastoral movie. What makes it a gothic movie?
Well, we have a whole section in the exhibition that deals with gothic literature and its spin-offs in the 20th and 21st centuries. In order to make that a manageable section, we've divided it into four subsections. And one of those is entitled The Dark Side of Nature, where you have people like Arthur Machen and Algernon Blackwood writing these kind of sinister short stories that scratch the surface of the idyllic pastoral, and underneath they find a dark side. You can see that being traced up through things like stories and novels and films that show animals going bad, or in the case of The Wicker Man, that kind of idyllic provincial, but it's not actually. It's dark out there outside of London in the provinces, and there's all kinds of stuff that we don't know what's going on. And it's that sense of mystery that ties The Wicker Man into what we've told before.
And there seems to be a very specific sense that this is English, or this is British. Gothic architecture started off in France. It was something that was taken up in Renaissance painting. But in terms of it as a literary movement, and more, as a more of a popular cultural movement rather than a high cultural movement, it's a very English thing, isn't
it? It is.
And it kind of goes back to the base of the ghost story and about, I presume, something about the written rather than the oral tradition. It's very important to write this stuff down.
Yeah. A lot of the things that inspired Walpole, though, were oral tales. So, I mean, one of the things that's key for that early period of Gothic is ballads. And those ballads that tell of, you know, daring do or bad things happening, that's all oral. And it's only written down at one point and ends up being written culture. There's not really a distinction between the written and the oral as far as Gothic goes. But I mean, the written is crucial to it. So all the way through the history of Gothic, you've got this idea that there's something forbidden or mysterious to be found in the written word. So all the way through history, even up to something like The Shining, you've got this idea of a forbidden text that once you read it, it sends you on a rampage or sends you bad. So it's crucial to Gothic.
And something like The Shining seems to be kind of exotic because it seems like it's such a classic kind of English ghost story that's put into an American kind of context, really, essentially.
Yeah.
It's got all the kind of gormenghastical, phantasmagorical elements of one of those old novels.
If you read the text, so King's novel, you can see, I mean, he puts in very explicit references to people like Walpole and Anne Radcliffe and other key Gothic writers. So King's definitely identifying The Shining as a Gothic novel, even though we now consider it to be a horror novel or a horror film. It's very definitely a Gothic tale.
And as the curator of this show at the British Library, can you pick up and put down Gothic, or does it get into your skin like a kind of a cold wind in a dungeon?
Oh yeah, no, it's definitely affected me quite a lot. I mean, I've discovered a lot.
I like to say Tim's coming only wearing black.
Yeah, I'm only doing this for the run of the exhibition, though. I'm usually more flamboyant. To be honest, before I did this, I wasn't the biggest Gothic or horror fan, but I've come to love it. And there's, you know, there have been some genuinely kind of life-changing things that we've discovered in the exhibition that, you know, will stick with me now for a long time. And I think that's, you know, that's true of Gothic. Once you become a fan of it, it's hard to drop it.
That was Tim Pye, curator of Terror and Wonder, the Gothic Imagination at the British Library. Book your tickets now at bl.uk/events, and we'd highly recommend it. Well, now we're all clued up on the roots of Gothicism, we're in a much better position to pick out our costumes for this year's celebrations. And what better place to do it than Angels in London? No, it's not a strip joint. The fancy dress shop on Shaftesbury Avenue has been providing outfits to actors and partygoers for almost 175 years and is the oldest and largest in the capital. It's a sort of haunted house meets Disney World, filled with grown-ups willing to spend their hard-earned money in the most childish way possible. Monocle's Guy Lutz headed down to meet Jeremy Angel, creative manager of the family-run business, who tells her more about what people are wearing this Halloween.
No, you put that on underneath, it'll be fine.
Angels has been going since 1840. We started actually round the corner from here on a barrow in Covent Garden, and what used to happen was my relative was a tailor, had loads of clothes, and actors used to come to him and want to borrow the clothes, because in those days, if you and I were going up for a part in a play, you were the better actress, but I had the costume, I'd get the role. So what happened was actors started coming and saying, can we borrow your costumes? And he said, no, you can hire them. And then this is what's happened. So since 1840, we moved into this building. This was our original premises. And we've been collecting costumes, making costumes ever since, and hiring them out to film and TV. And about 20 years ago or so, we started doing fancy dress so the general public could hire things.
How big of a role has Halloween played in these cheaper version costumes?
It's played a huge role. I mean, fancy dress has just changed massively. Unfortunately, I'd actually say since 9/11, there's been a massive shift in how Halloween's perceived over here, because you had a lot of Americans who didn't go back home. They stayed in London and they started throwing Halloween parties then. And it's just this huge change has just happened. And then the other thing is, it's the most selfish festival out of all of them. When you go shopping at Christmas, you're buying presents for someone else. Valentine's Day, someone else. Easter eggs for the children. Halloween, that's just for me. And the best thing with Halloween as well is, and I've seen it in the shops, ladies will come in here and they'll spend 2 hours sorting out their makeup, picking up the costumes, get on the phone to their other half and sit there and go, unless you get down here in the next 5 minutes, you're going as a ghost.
Things like that.
I've been reading some of the numbers that are of money into Halloween. They're growing every year. I mean, Planet Retail did that survey that counted it as the third most successful after Christmas and Easter for retail. How has your business grown in the last years?
You sit there and go, we started off with maybe 1 million visitors to the website one Halloween, and now you're looking at it, it's probably going to be 2 to 2.5 million visitors. And in as little as maybe 4 years, it's a huge jump. Order wise, the amount of people placing orders has doubled, if not tripled, year on year, and it keeps growing. And the numbers have been amazing. And you just need to look to America. I think the stat was something like 46% of all adults in America dressed up last year. 46% of all Americans. That's astonishing.
Now, getting out of the business side into the more fun things, Halloween 2014. Can you tell me, so far, what have people been looking for? What are the latest trends, or what are the latest additions to your collection of clothes? Because I can't imagine having anything else to add.
You'll be amazed. We do a theme every year here. And the reason for that is it's fun for us, and it also makes it easier for us to show customers, well, we've got all of these makeup looks that we did. And last year was a circus of horrors. There's a lot of circus stuff, rag dolls, clowns, evil clowns, really evil clowns. When you see some of the makeup looks that people are doing, you know why they're scared of clowns. And the other ones that are always big are Big Frank, which is the Frankenstein monster, but as Frank Sinatra. So it's bow tie and everything, but it's always been a popular costume. And then you've always got the typical fallen angels and zombies. Zombies are always big at the moment, but that's, you've got TV programs left, right and center, and films all about zombies. But circus is really big this year.
Do you mind if you have a few more minutes to take me around, show me a few parts or amazing costumes? Or
This is the ladies' floor. They're getting clever with what they do with things. So you can take a period dress and you make it out of the darker colours and everything, and it's stunning. So you've got this beautiful Victorian dress here, and normally any other time of year, it might go out for whatever the party is, but put a nice mask with it and some dark wig, and it suddenly comes to life. And then this is exactly what I'm talking about with the sort of the showgirl, the clown, the type ballerina. It's all mixed together. So again, the colours, and all it needs is makeup. It's very Beetlejuice-esque as well. So it's just a very simple look. So this is now the men's higher floor. So automatically you've just got a creepy clown now. And then you've obviously got a gangster as well, which is very easy, but they've sort of tweaked it slightly. So I'd actually even say this isn't gangster, this is Gangs of New York meets the Joker. So again, it's really easy to do. This is our first floor. And now what you have down here as well is all the accessories that you can buy, hats, signs that you might need. There's all accessories you'd want to make the perfect Halloween party, table covers, cobwebs, gravestones, blood splats for your windows, trick-or-treating boxes, spiders. Now this stuff over, let's go this, if I show you these. Now these look absolutely disgusting in a great way. These are called Tinsley transfers. They're 3D transfers. Now they work exactly how the transfer used to work. Do you remember the temporary tattoos you'd have as a child? Just put on with water and that's it. That's what these are done. These are made by...
They're 3D.
They're 3D. They're fantastic. Wow. They're made by a gentleman called Christian Tinsley, who is a makeup artist, special effects makeup artist in Hollywood, does lots of films and lots of TV in Hollywood. But he's come up and designed looks that work and are really easy for anyone to apply. So all you do is you literally cut it out, stick it on with water, and you have the most incredible look.
Wow. And bullets and scars and...
Oh, they've got pentagrams, they've got staples and bullet wounds and peeling skin and zips. And it looks great. Now, some people go, oh, yeah, but it's only for one use. Yes, but it's a fantastic one use.
It's supposed to be scary, no?
Yeah, but tricking
That was Jeremy Angel speaking to Monocle's Gaia Lutz at Angel's Fancy Dress Shop in London. After a break, we'll be giving you time to touch up your Halloween makeup as we pause the theme to find out what went on at this year's CMJ Music Marathon in New York.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. If you're a music insider, booker, journalist, or just a huge music fan, New York City was the place to be last weekend for the annual CMJ Music Marathon, now in its 34th year. It's the longest running showcase music festival of its kind. CMJ takes over 80 music venues for a week across the Lower East Side and Brooklyn. The festival's notoriety has been earned by famously breaking bands in the past, such as Arcade Fire, Mumford & Sons, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, and Feist, to name but a handful. Our reporter, Marcellas, travel to the festival in search of the latest up-and-coming artists. And remember, you heard it here first on Monocle.
Another October, another CMJ has come and gone. This year was much like many other years, with little sleep and so much to see and do in a city already with too much to see and do. Music industry folks gather along Ludlow Street in Manhattan's Lower East Side for a slew of afternoon gigs at infamous venues such as Piano's, Arlene's Grocery, and Cake Shop. I walk into Piano's and run into half of the British music industry, sipping from frozen cocktails and chatting about the latest bands they're pushing or excited to see. Adam Ryan, booker of the Great Escape Festival in Brighton.
I always feel like whenever I come to CMJ that I'm ahead of the curve, if that makes sense. So there's a lot of bands that I watch and see here that when I go back to the UK, I feel like I'm like 6 to 12 months ahead of things, if that makes sense, and doesn't come across too arrogant. But yeah, it's an amazing event. There's a lot to see here. I think they could probably do with like stripping back the amount of bands that they have. Sometimes when you look at it, it can be a little bit overwhelming, but it's good to come here and watch bands and then go back to the UK and kind of be ahead of the curve. I'm really excited to see Tishi. She's really good. And Ray and Weaver, that's quite a good show. I saw that last night. Lost in the cracks of the landslide. You saw me slipping on my blindside. I'm feeling lost, feeling tongue-tied. And now I'm frozen in your headlights. Deep in the haze of your love. CMJ isn't just about watching bands. Tasha Anastopoulos, PR manager for Landar, an online instant music mastering service from Montreal, Canada.
So right now, we've been set up for the last few days throughout the duration of CMJ at the Artisan Press Lounge. It's been really interesting. There's been a real nice overview of the kinds of artists that have been coming through to talk to us. We've been talking to a lot of hip-hop artists, producers, MCs, as well as somebody came over from Nashville, like making some country stuff today.
I get Tasha's CMJ music recommendations as well.
Okay, so essentially, I saw this guy's name on the CMJ lineup and said, if this is the only artist I see this entire festival, I would be so happy. So it's Moses Sumney. He's an LA-based artist. I call his music, I guess, ethereal soul. He is absolutely phenomenal, and he's playing at Rough Trade.
I know what it is to be broken and be bald. Tell you that my silver is gold.
In the evening, I head over to Brooklyn, where I find lead singer of Liquid Liquid and longtime New York resident, Salvador Principato.
I've been on the scene in New York City, the music scene, for 35 years, doing various projects. I've done promotions, I've DJed.
And this year, what is your involvement with CMJ?
Well, I'm just a fan, really, this year. You know, I am DJing tonight as part of a CMJ event.
You've been around in the New York scene for 35 years, and CMJ has been around for 34 years. How have you watched it evolve over the years?
Well, I think it's, you know, CMJ sort of set a bar that other people tried to live up to and then maybe surpassed. But CMJ has stayed pretty much, you know, according to its original intention, you know, being a showcase. And it's not too hyped out. Unlike, you know, South by Southwest, you know, it's not like this whole, you know, it's not over the top. It's manageable, you know, and it's pleasant. Like, it's not too much. And these things can be too much, you know, in many ways.
It may be manageable to some, but I'm finding CMJ exhausting, and I'm on the hunt for more music recommendations. Still in Brooklyn, I head to music venue Babies All Right, who are celebrating their one-year anniversary, having opened during CMJ last year by former pianos booker Billy Jones. James Mia, founder of Toronto record label Hand Drawn Dracula, is outside.
We had a great showcase at Palisades. Believe, Student Squad, Wish, Lobby. I'd say it was about half full. It's a brand new venue. It's a great new venue in Brooklyn.
Hand Drawn Dracula puts out some great records, so I asked for James's overall CMJ recommendations.
Well, I want to see Slow Dive. They're awesome. I think White Fence and A Place to Bury Strangers are also playing late on Saturday, so we'll probably head there after the Belief set.
I personally really enjoyed California's White Fence, London's Flowers, and Berlin's Ballet School, to name just a few of the many excellent bands playing CMJ this year. Booking a festival of this depth and magnitude definitely takes some time and consideration. Matt McDonald, programmer of CMJ.
So the booking process generally starts pretty soon after the previous year ends. So in November, December, we open up submissions, artists can submit online, and then we start our review process, and that's sort of a year-round thing. In terms of how the review process works, the most important thing is the band's music. We also take a look at their online profile, what kind of press they have, what kind of tour history there is, what kind of team they have in place, really just to get a better sense of who they are and what they where they're at in their career.
The festival ended less than 48 hours ago, so artist submissions haven't quite opened yet for 2015. However, I'd highly recommend playing or attending. For Monocle in New York, I'm Mar Sellers.
Thank you, Ma. And coming up in the second half of the show, more folky goodness from Seth Lakeman. Then we're back on track with Ghoulish Theme as we discover the creepy fictional town of Nightvale and find out what frightful delights are on offer at the Toronto After Dark Film Festival. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Seth Lakeman is our first port of call in this half of the show. He's playing tracks from his new record, Word of Mouth, which is out now on Honor Oak Records. And from it, here he is with The Shores of Normandy.
Cold grey light on the 6th of June in the year of 44. The Empire lads set out of Pool. The join with thousands more. The largest fleet the world had seen, we sailed in closer aid, and we set our course for Normandy at the dawning of the day. There was not one man and all our crew who knew what lay in store, for we had waited for that day for 5 long years of war. We knew that many would not return, and all our hearts were true, for who we were bound for Normandy, where we had job to do. Now the Empire Larch was a deep sea tug with a crew of 33. I was just the galley boy on my first trip out to sea. I had little thoughts when I left home, dreadful sights I'd see, and I came to manhood on the day I first saw Normandy. An iron match off the beach of gold beneath the rocket's deadly glare. We towed our block ships into place, built our harbor there. Amid shot and shell, we built it well, as history does agree, while brave men died in the swirling tide on the shores of Normandy. For every hero name that's known, a thousand died as well. On sticks and wires their bodies hung out in the ocean swell. And many a mother wept that day for the sons they loved so well. Men who cracked your joke, catched a smoke as he stormed the gates of hell. As the years passed by, I could still recall the men I saw that day, who died upon the blood-salt sand, when our sweet children. Those of you who were unborn, who've lived in liberty, come remember those who made it so on the shores of Normandy.
Seth Lakeman, thank you very much for that fantastic session. I wasn't expecting to be quite so moved first thing in the morning. I'm just getting over my breakfast and suddenly it's D-Day. It's, yeah. We're transported back. Yeah. I wanted to first of all talk about the fantastic song Shores of Normandy. It was just so moving and so real. The last time I saw you was on my television, involved in this BBC 70 years on from the D-Day event. Mm. Tell us a bit about how you got involved in that and perhaps how Shores of Normandy came to be.
Of course, yeah. I mean, that was such a moving occasion, the way the BBC put that on in the Royal Albert Hall, and it was streamed across to cinemas all around the country, and BBC Concert Orchestra there and the people who were involved. It was quite an emotional thing to be part of. I mean, I was invited to sing a song that I'd written for my grandfather when he was still alive about 10 years ago, called King and Country or The Longest Day, and it's really telling his story, his journey. And just by coincidence, he was actually featuring in the show that was being written already. So his voice was heard just before I was about to play the song. And then there was a picture of him right above me. So it was quite a moving experience to sing that song. He's passed away now, 3 or 4 years ago, but a big thing for our family, you know, for the name Lakeman. We're very proud of him. He was our hero, really, and landed at Juno Beach. And while I was there, I met Jim Radford, who also performed a song, an 85-year-old veteran. He performed a song he wrote telling his story as a 15-year-old sailor going over to Normandy to land at Arromanche Beach. He said to me when I was there, you know, Seth, you must keep singing this song. It's the only song he's ever written. And so I felt responsibility to learn it. I should go home, learn this. And I did. So I've just started playing it in the last few weeks. And I thought I'd play it for you.
And so let's talk about the album Word of Mouth. So this is your 7th album. How easy or difficult was this one to write and produce?
It was quite ambitious. The concept came first, Word of Mouth. I wanted to, as I've been talking about songs and stories from people, I wanted to talk to people, interview them, and like a journalist would, I guess, extract those stories and try and turn them into songs. So I set about doing it, and then I ended up, after a good year or so, with 100 or more interviews. I set myself for a good few months and started trying to work out the best ones. So really, it's a journalistic-led record. It's about these people from around the West Country. You know, I went from all the way from Dorset all the way down to the fringes of Cornwall. And I spoke to farmers, to gypsies, to World War II veterans, to all sorts of walks of life. And each one wasn't necessarily forced. I was just, sometimes it's a chain of events, you know, that leads you to them. But I found it really interesting project to do. And, you know, it's quite educational, actually, because you learn so much about the people. And it's a whole different perspective of songwriting itself.
And give us an idea of sort of setting you recorded it in, because I'm picturing an old cabin.
Yeah.
A dog lazing by a fire.
It's kind of like that.
Am I close?
Yeah, it's on the moors. So Dartmoor, I live on Dartmoor. I have a spring spaniel. We've got an open fire.
Okay.
I'm not sure what it was on at the time. I was writing in the summer. So, but yeah, it's that sort of picture. I mean, the sort of people I met, yeah, I was just remembering because one of them sticks in my mind is a guy called Tony Haworth, who I wrote a song called The Last Rider about him. I just remember being at the steam preservation railway down in Bodmin, and he took me for a ride on the steam engine. And this 80-year-old guy talking about the days of steam, and he was screaming and you know, getting the fire stoked up, and we're flying along. And I just remember that feeling, thinking, this is what it's all about, you know? This a song has taken me to this place to meet this incredibly, you know, inspiring man. And there I am flying down, feeling like I'm a 10-year-old boy, you know? And then I ended up writing that song, Last Rider, for him, yeah.
That was Seth Lakeman speaking to Monocle's Paul Noble. For dates and music, head to sethlakeman.co.uk. We mean gig dates, not romantic ones. Sorry, ladies. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I am Robert Bound. It's Halloween this week, so we're exploring the spookier side of things. Welcome to Night Vale. It's a surreal take on community radio. It tells the tale of a curious fictional town in the middle of the American desert, where the extraordinary is ordinary and the ordinary is extraordinary. Each episode is presented by a character called Cecil Gershwin Palmer, who announces the local news, weather and calendar, but not as you'd normally hear it. Expect floating cats, devilish librarians, angels in the car park, and a five-headed dragon called Hiram McDaniels. The bi-monthly podcast is the creation of New York-based Jeffrey Craner and Joseph Fink. It's a dark comedy that's been compared to Twin Peaks and the writing of Stephen King. In its 2 years of existence, Welcome to Night Vale has been so successful that they're currently touring a live performance to sold-out audiences across Europe. Producer Holly headed up to their recent London show at the Union Chapel, where she spoke to the lead actor, Cecil Baldwin, about the simple production techniques used to create an effectively eerie broadcast.
Regret nothing until it is too late. Then regret everything. Welcome to Night Vale. We kind of rely on very simple technological aspects, and then we let the writing and the performance kind of come through, and that has served us very well. And I think that's a testament to the writing that the boys do, and, you know, hopefully the performance that I give. But when it comes to the eerie, creepy aspect of it, I love it because it's equal parts scary, funny,
and literary. My favorite comparison is Twin Peaks, which has moments of absolute absurd comedy, and then a few minutes later, it is some of the scariest TV program you'll ever see, and being able to deftly move back and forth between that while also having emotionally grounded, relatable characters. And I hope that we tap into that same sort of vibe. And now, a look at the community calendar. Saturday, the public library will be unknowable. Citizens will forget the existence of the library from 6 a.m. Saturday morning until 11 p.m. that night. The library will be under a sort of renovation. It is not important what kind of renovation.
We should probably explain a little bit about how the programs are actually structured. So it's supposed to be like a community radio broadcast, and there's all the sort of elements of local news, and there's the weather report, although the weather report's not the sort of weather report you may be used to. You actually play a song by a different artist each week. What came first? Was it the idea of Night Vale, or was it wanting to do a program based around a community radio station?
Well, Joseph came up with the idea. He was he's a writer, and I think he just wanted to try something other than print. And he listens to a ton of podcasts, and he kind of looked at all the different podcasts that were available, and there was nothing really like this. I think he came up with the idea of Night Vale after he decided, I want to do something that is in this format. And the idea of a radio show just seemed like the most logical fit. Here's something odd. There is a cat hovering in the men's bathroom at the radio station here. He seems perfectly happy and healthy, but it's floating about 4 feet off the ground next to the sink.
As much as it's about Night Vale, it's also very much about your character. You follow him through a love story and, you know, a lot of things that he goes through in day-to-day life, which I guess is the sort of thing you would get from a normal radio presenter as well. Do you think this is what makes it so relatable? You've got an incredible fan base. Do you think it's the fact that there is like a human aspect to it, even though it is so bizarre?
Oh, absolutely. There's something so intimate about the format of radio. It is a voice that comes to you and only to you. If you see a piece of live theater or a movie, you're having that experience with a couple of hundred of other people versus radio, which is something very singular. And especially, essentially what we're doing, which is radio theater, it allows you to create the locations and the characters in your own mind, which adds another aspect of individualizing the experience per person.
Hello, radio audience. I come to you live from under my desk, where I've dragged my microphone and am currently hiding in the fetal position. Did you write letters? Maybe you should not do this anymore. Station management has opened its door for the first time in my memory and is now roaming the building. I don't know exactly what management looks like, as that is when I took cover under my desk, and I can only hope that they are not listening to what's going out right now, or else I may have sealed my fate.
How do you put a podcast onto the stage? Does the audience sort of interact when you do it live, or do they stay very quiet and just imagine it as if it was happening over, like, through their iPod or something?
It's very much the former. The podcast is a very singular experience. You listen to it in your car, or it happens in your headphones. It's a very individual experience. Theater at its best is a communal experience. And this gives our listeners, our fans, a chance to not only experience the show itself, but to experience other people that are just as into the show as they are. We don't wear costumes. We don't use props. Like, there's no on-air sign. It's not representative in that way. We're not really going in that direction. And at the same time, the audience brings this really amazing energy to the live performances that is, it's reminiscent of Rocky Horror Picture Show, where
people will come dressed as their favorite characters, and they'll kind of boo the baddies and cheer the goodies. And I mean, we've had audiences that have been more active and less active, and people who have really, the comedy has spoken to them, and other audiences where the sort of heartfelt drama is spoken to them, or the scary parts have really kind of latched onto them. There's no such thing as a perfect performance or a perfect audience. And I just hope that every audience is entertained and walks away thinking, wow, that was a really amazing, entertaining experience. The sky tonight is a soft, quivering green. The wind is calm, but prepared. Get your sleep, Night Vale, and don't forget to dream. Good night.
That was actor Cecil Baldwin talking to Holly Fisher. Welcome to Night Vale is available to download on iTunes and is best listened to under the covers with a torch to hand. After the break, we're cranking creepy up to horrifying at the Toronto After Dark Film Festival.
Food on film. We travel to Helsinki to meet the merchants serving up the very best in Nordic cuisine at Helsinki's oldest portside market.
Service and quality are at the very heart of the market's reinvention and its continued importance over the past 120 years. Many of the stall holders have held pitches in these pinewood stalls for generations and forged close relationships with their long-held customers.
Market Value, now playing in the film section of Monocle.com.
This is Culture with me, Robert Bounds. While Toronto's International Film Festival, or TIFF, gets all the attention, the city has more than enough festivals throughout the year to keep film buffs of all types satisfied. When plastic skeletons pop up on neighbourhood lawns and the sun begins to set a little earlier over the skyline, Toronto's After Dark Film Festival comes out to play. The festival is just one of many worldwide celebrating the horror genre and its ability to tell fascinating stories and provide cutting social commentary under the guise of macabre fun. Featuring horror, cult and sci-fi cinema from all over the world, the Toronto After Dark Festival is currently celebrating its ninth year of screening All That Goes Bump in the Night. Monocle's Jeremy Shipper speaks to festival programmer Justin McConnell about this year's offerings and the current trends in horror.
Toronto After Dark started in 2006 by Adam Lopez, who is a very enthusiastic UK-based gentleman who came over here, and he noticed a niche that could be filled in the city. There were lots of festivals, but nothing that catered specifically to horror, sci-fi, cult, action movies. Of course, TIFF had Midnight Madness, and that was, you know, a week of screenings at midnight that catered towards that, but not a festival that strictly focused on that. And because he was such a lover of that, he created this festival. One thing that's different with this year is that we had so much choice out there, and there were so many high-profile titles that this year, compared to any previous one, almost all of our titles, they draw like crazy. We've had 11 sellout screenings already, which is a giant record for us. I mean, the highest sellouts before, I think, was 4, and that's because the films we're playing are already on people's radar in a lot of ways and high-profile enough, mostly, to be able to bring in large crowds. But some of the smaller films are excellent too. I mentioned Wormwood, which is an Australian zombie movie that these guys basically shot over a period of a few years for very, very little money, but the energy just shows. It's like an early Peter Jackson movie. Tonight, for example, we're playing The Town That Dreaded Sundown remake, which it's sort of a remake, sort of a sequel, sort of a reimagining produced by Blumhouse, who are the people that released the Paranormal Activity movies, and it's a fairly large film, so we're playing that, and then right after that we're playing a documentary about the horror genre. So it's a huge variety of things.
There are different trends within horror films that make it into the cultural zeitgeist at the time. For example, in the 60s, zombies were really big because they represented the rise of consumer culture and the images on TV from Vietnam. What do you think would be the sort of current zeitgeist of horror films?
Well, zombies never really went away. In terms of them representing the consumer culture, that was more a 70s thing, the 60s, because Night of the Living Dead was 1968. That was the first time you had the shambling, flesh-eating zombie. But beyond that, zombies are still huge. a friend of mine at Anchor Bay always says, you're never going to go broke releasing a zombie movie because there's just always an audience for it. But in terms of what's big right now, supernatural horror is huge. There's a new movie out every week, you know, Ouija or Annabelle, things like that, where, you know, it's about a small family unit and it's a fairly small film, but, you know, it's a ghost that's tormenting them or a demon or something like that. That seems to be what's really popular now.
There are things happening that I can't explain.
We should talk to someone.
I don't think what you're experiencing is a ghost.
As for the future, that's anyone's guess, although I've seen an uptick in Sasquatch movies in the last couple of years, which I don't think Sasquatch will ever be as big as, say, zombies, but you never know. I mean, over the years, the same stories and the same monsters get recycled and recycled and recycled, which is fine, but it's up to the filmmaker to bring something new to the table. And I think when something really new comes to the table, for example, in the 90s, when Scream kind of brought back the slasher movie a bit. I mean, it never really went away, but there was a period of time when the slasher movies just weren't being made, or when they were flying way below people's radar because they got tired of it in the early 80s with, you know, with Halloween and Friday the 13th and the countless imitators. So usually what happens is a popular film will come out. It'll be so popular that it'll launch a whole bunch of copycats, which will be good or bad. Then we're in a situation where, yeah, there's a trend. But at this point, I think the biggest trend is that people are bucking convention. Because the tech is so cheap now, and because a lot of people can go out and make a movie for very inexpensively, it may not be mainstream horror. You're always going to see the trends. They're always just going to follow the same trends because that puts asses in seats. But with indie horror, there's so much really original stuff out right now. Things like Spring, which I saw at TIFF, by Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead.
You're the most attractive person I've ever seen, but that doesn't outweigh that you might be a mental patient, and I gotta make sure you're the kind of crazy I can deal with.
No.
I'm a bunch of confusing biochemistry and some crazy hormones.
Where it's essentially a Richard Linklater-style Before Sunrise type movie that just happens to have sort of a Lovecraftian horror angle to it, and it's, you know, but it's that sort of relationship drama first. So you're seeing people take all these different genres and meld them together.
That was Justin McConnell, festival programmer for Toronto After Dark, speaking to Monocle's Jeremy Shipper, bringing us to the end of this spooky show. Next week, we'll be assessing Art Review's Power 100, and there's live music from Asaf Avidan. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher, who this week was just an apparition of her normal perfect self. Time for one final song this week from Seth Lakeman. Here he is with The Courier. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in.
The high road winds and loops. Watches smooth the stones where the weary figure stoops. Still in the night, there's a cross he must find. Come the courier alone, and the flurry of suffering. Past a sinking bridge to the surging river spray. Still in the night, there's a cross he must find. A barking stone, the highway home. A barking stone, the highway home from here. Come the courier alone through the vivid woods ablaze. A wild fever forms the pinnacle of his gaze. Still in the night, there's a cross he must find. A barking stone, the highway home. Barking stone, the highway home from here. Come the courier alone, through the carting moon so bright. Come the wayside crowd, the silhouette of green and white. Still in the night, there's miles across he must find a barking stone, the highway home, a barking stone.